This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. Up ahead on the program, we have our usual book news, and then at 32 minutes and 50 seconds into the program, we have a discussion on Galileo and the Church, and then Steve Nichols on Martin Luther. All this and more ahead on the Reformed Media Review. Welcome to the Reformed Media Review, a reformed look at books and audio and video, other types of things. My name is Camden Busey, and I have with me Jeffrey C. Waddington, who's teacher of the congregation at Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. We've got a lot to talk about here, but before we get to that, we're going to introduce Josh Walker, who's a student at RTS Jackson. It's great to have you back, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. We haven't been doing a whole lot of Reformed Media Reviews, but we finally got one back out in the feed, and because it's been a while, we have a lot of books to talk about.
We've
been recording ahead of schedule for Christ the Center, so that means we can't stay up to date with the books because the recordings go out a little bit later. So anyway, we have quite a few recordings to talk about today, and then after that, we're going to get into a few clips. I've got a few clips drummed up that we're going to chat about and comment about the views set forth therein. But Jeff, we might as well get started because we've got plenty to mention. You said you had a whole pile of books sitting there.
Yeah. Before we do that, just one thing. We want to remind our listeners that Josh is involved with Bring the Books.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah, I've been mentioning that at the end, but Bring the Books.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an excellent blog. Check that
out. Well, the reason I brought that up is Josh reminded me, but you had a recent interchange with New Testament scholar Craig Blomberg. Tell us about that. Middle Knowledge, right? How'd that go?
It went well. We're still actually in the middle of having that conversation. It's my turn to reply. He put up an article called Why I'm a Calminian on the Zondervan blog, and I responded to one of the points he raised in his introduction. He was talking about how since there are godly men on both sides of the debate over Calvinism and Arminianism, that a middle ground would seem to be the preferred view. And I kind of took him to task on that point, bringing up Athanasius as an example of somebody who, if he were to count heads of the theologians of his day, would have came to the conclusion that Christ was not divine, but good thing he didn't, and that he stood for the biblical teaching of the divinity of Christ. So he came on in the blog and actually commented on it, and was very gracious. I was very honored to have him on the blog. I mean, he's a well-respected New Testament scholar. I've benefited greatly from his writings. Some of his stuff on the reliability of the New Testament was pivotal in my early years of Christianity, of coming to a solid conviction of the New Testament record. So I have a lot of respect for Dr. Blomberg.
Yeah, I mean, he's as you've mentioned, he's done work on the Synoptics and on John. And in fact, one of the forthcoming titles is, a new edition of a work that's been out previously. So let's dive into forthcoming books, and then we'll talk about a few that I've got on my shelf with me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First one is an interesting title. It's a reprinting because I have an edition, probably 10 years old now, but The Heart of an Executive, Lessons on Leadership from the Life of King David by somebody named Rick Phillips.
we haven't heard of him.
Yeah, this may be the first book he had published ever. I'm not sure, but it came out before he actually graduated from the MDiv program. Because you know he has a master's degree, at least one, other than the MDiv, I believe in business, from the Wharton School.
Oh, wow.
Did you know that he was a professor at West Point?
No, I did not. I did not know that.
Oh, my. Well, that might account for the kind of book this is, right? The Heart of an Executive. Interesting book for those of you who are, interested in putting into practice lessons you might learn from King David. Okay.
Well, we also want to recommend the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Prophets.
Yeah, that's right. That would be a very
that's just a dumb joke. No, this book
that's a very profitable book.
Rick's book's a really handy one. That's a good one to go read.
That was bad.
That was a Jeff. I'm trying to bounce back. I'm trying to bounce the
jokes
back.
Yeah, I have to dig out my copy. I read it some years ago when it first came out. I may have even gotten Rick to sign it. I don't remember. Because we were in a couple of classes together.
Oh, wow.
All right, let's see. The Gospel of John and Christian Theology by Richard Baucom. Wow. That looks like a book that we'll want to get a hold of. If you remember his recent book on the eyewitness nature of the Synoptic Gospels, or the Gospels, a top-notch work. You want to look for that one. Due out actually this month, but apparently not in the store yet.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Fee, a well-known New Testament scholar, has a commentary on 1st and 2nd Thessalonians coming out in Icknot. You want to be on the lookout for that. That's a fairly large commentary, I think, because it's almost $45, the price. So you want to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I imagine that would be really good.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Again, he's a charismatic, but he's a New Testament scholar of significance.
Yeah, par excellence. They don't get much better.
No, it's true. Jesus and the Gospels, an Introduction and Survey, second edition. That's the book by Craig Blomberg that I was thinking of earlier. Let's see what else we have here that would be... A lot of things have been... they were announced a while back, and we've probably talked about them already. I don't know if you've ever read Marva Dawn. She's a thoughtful writer. She's got a new book coming out in the beginning, God, Creation, Culture, and the Spiritual Life. You want to keep that in mind. Those of you who like Craig Keener's commentary on Matthew, there's a paperback edition coming out in August. This is a major one. The Republication of the Semantics of Biblical Language by James Barr.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's of course he's passed away, so I'm sure he's not immediately behind the republication of this work, but you want to keep that one in mind. Here's one that I think our listeners will be interested in: The Deliverance of God, an Apocalyptic Rereading of Justification in Paul. I don't know how good it is or bad it is, as the case may be, but you'll want to keep your eyes open for that.
Who's the author?
David Douglas Campbell.
Okay.
It's $60, so it's not cheap.
Academic title.
Yes, I would think so.
When is that due out?
August, next
August.
Month.
Okay.
Now, there's also, this is one that I think I can recommend, even though I don't have it, is... The Calvin Handbook by Herman Selderhaus. You may recognize that name.
Yeah, we've talked about him before. Right.
He wrote the one of the new
John Calvin, A Pilgrim's Life.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this looks like it'll be a nice companion to that study. Very engagingly written, of course. Okay, I think that does it for forthcoming titles for me, but I think Josh has... a few titles he wanted to mention.
Yeah, I just did some searching today and found a couple that I thought our listeners might be interested in. The first one is by Michael Bird. It's called Are You the One Who Is to Come? The Historical Jesus and the Messianic Question. It basically, from the bio I have here, it looks like it's going to be about Jesus's self-consciousness as Messiah. Did Jesus believe himself to be the Messiah?
Like the self-disclosure.
Yeah, exactly.
Voss has an excellent older book on the subject called The Self-Disclosure of Jesus.
Yeah, this book's due out August 09. It's going to be about $23. It's from Baker. I think it's Baker Academic Publishing. And it's got some really good endorsements, one by De Silva that is highly... praising of the book, so it looks like one that definitely would be interested for anyone in New Testament studies. There's also one coming out by Brian Chappell. It looks like it might be a sequel to his book Christ-Centered Preaching called Christ-Centered Worship, Letting the Gospel Shape Our Practice. And This is also by Baker Academic. It's out in October of 2009. So it'd be about how Christ is to shape, and our understanding of the gospel shape what we do in worship. So that looks like it. It'll be an interesting volume, and D.A. Carson gives it a pretty good review as well. And then we've got one by Michael Horton called The Gospel-Driven Life, Being Good News People in a Bad News World. This is, again, also by Baker Books, and this is about $20. It looks like it's coming out in paperback in October. So it looks like it might be a kind of a sequel to Christ to Christless Christianity. It's kind of the gist of it that I got. And then the last one I wanted to mention was The 5 Points of Calvinism, a Study Guide. It's kind of a study guide to go along with Edwin Palmer's book on the 5 Points of Calvinism. This one has a introduction by Michael Horton, and that's due out in April of 2010.
Is that a republication?
Yeah, I think it's the third edition. I think that it's going to be updated and revised for a third edition of this book, but it's a study guide format, so I imagine that it'll have questions at the end and to help stimulate discussion and stuff. So,
very nice. Hey, you just triggered my memory. Two things. One is a book I think that is out now by Michael Bird called Introducing Paul. You want to be on the lookout for that one. And the second is Mike Horton has a full-fledged systematic theology coming about a year from now or sometime in 2010 from Zondervan. How it relates to the four-volume set, I'm not quite sure, but it's not the same thing. So you want to be on the lookout for that.
Huh.
If you go to Kim Riddlebarger, his Riddle blog, or to Heidelblog, Scott Clark's blog, you'll see, I think they've got the cover art already for the book. It's Christian Theology, a Pilgrim's something or other.
Yeah, the Christian Faith, a Systematic Theology for Pilgrims on the Way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And does it give the page count? Seemed like it was going to be quite a big volume.
I'm looking at worldcat.org. If anyone's interested, just as a side note, worldcat.org is a great catalog service
if you're
searching for books. And if you use that in conjunction with Zotero, which is an add-on you can get for Firefox, the browser, that's how I keep track of the libraries. And that's how I put the bibliographies out for every episode. So,
does it give the release date on that, Cameron?
2010. It doesn't say any month, okay, though.
On the Zondervan website, it has April of 2010.
Okay.
It'll be hardback for $39.99 right now is the price listed. I don't see a page count, though. I'm trying to find that for you.
Right. But at that price, is probably at least 300 to 400 pages, I would guess.
Yeah, actually, it's 960 pages.
Oh, okay.
And it actually weighs 1 pound.
Oh,
a 1 pound book.
Yeah. Okay.
Nice. Well, what else do we have?
Okay. Well, in terms of things that are in my grubby little hands, actually, I washed them, so they're not so grubby.
That's good.
Anthony N.S. Lane's Reader's Guide to Calvin's Institutes is available, or at least I have a advanced copy, perhaps. It's quite nice. I'm teaching a class, Sunday school class, to the adults in my church on Calvin's life and theology, and this is quite nice. I can recommend it. It's similar to, I don't know, you may have seen Ford Lewis Battles has an outline volume of the Institutes, and this one does follow the Ford Lewis Battles John McNeil edition of Calvin's Institutes. So it's a very helpful, what I would call an annotated outline. It's 100-some-odd pages, so it's more than just a bare-bones outline.
Wonderful.
It gives you a summary of each chapter and section. I mean, it's great in terms of then being, you can look in here and then find, okay, that's, I'm looking to, you know, I want to see what Calvin says about, say, the cross, right? And this is really great.
But we're going to have to give the ST teacher's aides that book so they can cross-check all the digests with that book.
Well, hey, bud, that's part of what I do.
Well, there you go, Jeff. So now you know.
I
next
got it
time
already.
You're grading digests.
Okay, then the next book is the next several are Mentor publications. This one's called Creation, Fall, Restoration, The Biblical Theology of Creation. And it is a defense of 6-24-hour traditional reading, but very learned. And actually has all our favorite guys in the bibliography. The gentleman, I'm not sure, he has Reformed leanings, but he may be more Baptistic. But this is a thorough treatment of the creation and flood, interacting with the various views of creation.
Who's the editor?
Well, it's a single author.
A single author? Who is it?
Kulikovsky.
How do you spell that?
Kulikovsky.
Huh.
And he lives in Australia. But it's it looks to be quite... The print is small for a guy like me that's tough, but it's it looks to be a fairly thorough discussion. As I read it, I'll you know, report back to all of you about that.
Creation, fall. Does he interact with the framework view that you can
yes,
tell?
Yes, he
just
does. That's
glance?
What I meant. I'm sorry. I meant to say to actually tell you what views he interacts with. But he interacts with the views that the PCA and the OPC have dealt with, the day age view. Intermittent day view, literary framework view, and literal day view. So I'm not sure. Day age may also cover analogical day. Not quite sure. I'll report back to you after I've read it. So that's Creation, Fall, and Restoration. Then there's a nice little book by Christopher Ash called The Priority of Preaching. Now, this is connected with the Proclamation Trust. Are anybody familiar with the Proclamation Trust?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Proclamation Trust is a ministry over in the UK. I don't think it's limited to evangelical Anglicans, but it certainly is very much an evangelical Anglican ministry related to the what they call the Cornhill Training Course. And this is a book... intended by the author, Christopher Ash. It's got a kind of a somewhat humorous introduction for discouraged preachers. let me just read this one paragraph on it. I think it will give you a sense of the whole thing, okay? Some years ago, I remember attending a large conference of ministers. At the time, I was pastoring an ordinary local church, which consisted of mainly ordinary people in a very ordinary place, a village in eastern England. Sad to say, all I can remember of the conference is impressive speakers who all seemed, to my jaded eyes, to be tall, handsome, and successful. Everything I was not. Above all, they seemed to talk a lot about doing strategic work for the gospel of Christ. It all seemed very strategic. They were clearly strategic people in strategic places doing strategic ministry. I, however, being of a melancholic disposition, was quite sure I was not a strategic person, nor was I in a strategic place, and I was most certainly not doing strategic ministry. As I left the conference, like a dog with its tail between its legs, I wondered if I was really worth it was really worth preparing for Sunday's preaching. And the whole goal of this brief book of 120 two pages is to instill a love of expository preaching and actually, in fact, a lectio continua form of preaching.
Wonderful.
In fact, the appendix at the end is called Give God the Microphone. The seven blessings of consecutive expository preaching. So that's the new name for lectio continua, consecutive expository preaching. So you want to keep that in mind. And now, a book by a man who we've interviewed. It's called Heroes and Heretics, Pivotal Moments in 20 Centuries of the Church by Ian Campbell.
Mm.
You remember Dr. Campbell?
Oh, yeah. We had a wonderful discussion with him on the Song of Solomon.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, did you know that he's in between? I'm not sure if he's actually made his move. He's moving from the church in
Isle of Lewis? Oh,
yeah, I think it's still on the Isle of Lewis, but okay. I could be wrong. But it's not the back church, Free Church of Scotland. if he listens to this, he can correct me or confirm what I'm saying at some point in the future, or email me and reprimand me for my stupidity. but anyway, this is what he does. These are based on a series of classes he taught at church. And what he did was to treat the whole 2,000 years of church history century by century. And this looks like a very nice little book. And Carl Truman, in fact, has this to say: in an age where Christians are increasingly ignorant of their historical roots, Dr. Campbell has done us a great service by achieving the near impossible, covering 2,000 years of church history in 20 brief but highly informative chapters. A great place to start for anyone who wants to deepen their understanding of how the church has witnessed to Christ throughout the ages. So you want to keep your eye.
Has this been out before? Because it's got the date of 2004.
I don't know that the text is any different, but it was originally done in 2004. And the cover of the book looks kind of like a chessboard with chess pieces above and below the title.
Okay.
So you want to? He's a good writer, Dr. Campbell is.
That's wonderful.
Who are some of the guys that he covers as the heroes and heretics?
Yeah, he does. Okay, let me see if I can. First century. By the way, each chapter has a section of highlights. So I mean, things you can scan. Let's see here. Marcion, Polycarp, Justin Martyr. Irenaeus, Tertullian, that's in the early church. Third century, Origen and Cyprian. Fourth century, let's go. Conversion of Constantine, Council of Nicaea, Arianism, Council of Constantinople, and Augustine becomes Bishop of Hippo. Teaching of Pelagius condemned, that this is the fifth century. Council of Ephesus, Council of Chalcedon, and the Roman Empire in the West.
Wonderful.
So anyways, that gives you an idea. It's not a big book, so it's a good place to start. Probably for people in the pew who are not as familiar with their church history, a good place to begin. And here I have what I can only describe as a commentary that exemplifies Calvin's goal or maxim of a brevitas or brevitas et claritas, brevity and clarity. This is David McWilliam's Galatians commentary as part of the Mentor commentary series.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a very, very fascinating volume. Now, I want to read a couple things to you just because, first of all, he wrote it with a PCA minister by the name of Paul Joyner in mind. Does that name ring a bell to you at all, Joshua?
It doesn't. It's not a name I've come across.
Okay. He's the campus minister for RUF at the University of South Florida. Now, here's the thing. People who helped him, see if you recognize some of these names, okay? Richard Gaffin.
Yeah, I know who that is.
I think I've heard of him.
Yeah. Dennis Johnson.
Yes.
Dustin Udaly. Anybody here know Dustin Udaly?
I don't know Dustin, no.
You don't know Dustin? Oh, my. Dustin was a classmate of mine at Westminster.
Oh, yeah.
He serves in a PCA congregation down in the Tampa, Florida. He's the associate pastor, I believe, along with Steve Caselli, who's a former director of admissions here at Westminster. But here's the one that I thought you might be interested in. Well, I mean, most interested in. I am deeply appreciative, especially I want to thank my former student at Westminster Seminary, Reverend Glenn Clary, who read drafts of the manuscript but has field-tested portions of it in his sermon preparation for his series on Galatians.
Wonderful.
So I thought you'd get a kick out of that. And let's see. A heavy tome, The Westminster Confession into the 21st Century, Volume 3. We've been waiting a long time for this, baby.
Yes, we have. It's finally out.
This is the – now, Joshua can't talk because he's kind of he's biased, and he would he would, you know, there could be conflict of interest here. So, just kidding. The editors, of course, Lig Duncan is the general editor. Then Derek Thomas, Jerry O'Neill, Rick Canada, Duncan Rankin, William McMillan, and J. Nicholas Reed. Now, Nicholas Reed has been what would you call it, the editorial assistant with Reformed Academic Press, I think.
Yeah, correct. He's kind of revitalized that since he's come to work with Lig and Duncan at First Press.
Huh.
Yeah. So I actually helped edit a couple of those chapters in that volume.
See awesome. What I mean? He's biased.
You can't take his...
No, he's an insider. That's the great thing about this kind of a program. We get the people who are on the inside track, right? Well, here are some of the contributors to give you an idea. Remember, this is a series. This is the third and final volume. I think it's the final volume. Dealing with the historical, theological, political circumstances surrounding the Westminster Assembly and, of course, its document that it produced. Excellent set, by the way, in my opinion. Here are some of the chapters and authors. The Westminster Assembly at Work. Who do you think might have written that one?
Oh, Chad Van Dixhorn.
Very good. Okay. Redemptive historical themes in the Westminster Larger Catechism. That's Ooh. Robert J. Cara.
Okay.
Subscription to the Confession. Roland Ward.
Oh, yeah.
You know Roland, right?
Know of him.
Okay, you haven't had the privilege of meeting him. He preached when I was still a member of Calvary Glenside, Calvary OPC in Glenside, across the street from the Westminster Seminary. He came and preached. Quite a preacher. So got to meet him. And then I, book buyer at the Westminster Bookstore, I worked with him in getting his books across the continent. Okay, 39 articles at the Westminster Assembly by Robert Norris. That ought to be interesting. I mean, a lot of people probably don't realize that the Westminster Assembly, when it first was called, had the task of actually revising the 39 articles, which are the doctrinal standard of the Church of England.
Right.
And then they eventually decided to scrap that and start fresh. Anyways, well, the nature of the Lord's Supper, Calvin and the Westminster on the Lord's Supper, improving the means of grace, the Westminster Standards and the Structure of Christian Ethics, and then Lig and Duncan has a section on recent objections to covenant theology. So that's, my Lord, there's a lot there.
Yeah, finally. The one on ethics is excellent article.
By David Jones.
Yeah. Right?
He's an emeritus professor at Covenant Seminary.
Oh, wow.
One more book, and this may be the most fascinating or unusual book. It's called Kinship by Covenant, A Canonical Approach to the Fulfillment of God's Saving Promises by Scott Hahn. Well, this, believe it or not, this is published by Yale Anchor Press. This is part of the Anchor Biblical Library. So this is almost 600 pages. Many of you may know that Scott Hahn is a former Protestant minister who went Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he trained at Westminster, but it says in the book that he trained under Gordon Hugenberger and Meredith Klein at Gordon Conwell.
Right.
But anyways, this is taking from my scanning of the book, and this was recommended by our friend Roth Reason, who's an OPC minister in the Philadelphia Presbytery, pastoring, is it Danville, Camden, you know?
Roth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up in the Poconos.
Yeah, Danville.
He emailed me and said, "Have you heard of this book?" So I contacted Yale and they sent it to me.
What was the title of it again from Scott Hahn?
Kinship by Covenant, a canonical approach to the fulfillment of God's saving promises. Now, the reason why it's interesting is that it's a covenant theology from a Roman Catholic perspective, but he's using, or at least he's attempting to build off of Meredith Klein and Gerhardus Voss.
That's very peculiar.
Well, that's why Roth emailed me. He said, this is something you might want to look over. So, and it's a substantial volume. It's like a $40 or $50 volume. If you go to Amazon.
They've got it on sale for $36.
Okay, yeah. It's a part of a prestigious series, that Anchor Biblical.
Yale Biblical or Bible Reference Library, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good series.
Huh.
So this is and if you actually go to, if you look on Amazon, he's been a prolific writer.
Oh yeah, Scott Hahn is quite Roman Catholic celebrity.
Yeah, but not only but not all apologetics. See, I knew him from the apologetics angle, not from the biblical studies angle.
Sure.
This is not, I mean, I'm sure apologetics is not, is, you know, playing in the background, but Scott Hahn is currently a professor of scripture. Let me correct that. He's the Pope Benedict XVI, chair of biblical theology at St. Vincent's Seminary in La Trobe here in Pennsylvania, professor of scripture and theology at the Franciscan University of Steubenville in Steubenville, Ohio, and founder and president of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. So it's one I'm going to read through, and I will report back on at a future date.
Yeah.
But I wanted, that's such a kind of an odd, not an odd book. Well, it is from our angle, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
Trying to do a Roman Catholic theology, trying to benefit from the insights of Meredith Klein and Gerhardus Voss. Quite interesting. Hmm. So that's it for the books that I have.
I have one more to mention, and I hope to do a written up review shortly for the web, but it's Mark Knoll's latest, entitled The New Shape of World Christianity, How American Experience Reflects Global Faith. We did mention that on episode 72 of Christ the Center, but I thought I'd mention it again, and I've read about half of it, and I've really enjoyed it so far. And he's arguing that in order to understand the new shape that global Christianity is taking, we need to understand the shift in Christianity that occurred when it moved from Europe to America. That's his the kernel of his thesis there, and so he draws out several themes and attempts to defend them. And I've enjoyed what I've read so far. It's an interesting book from InterVarsity Press. So you'll hear more about that in the future. But Mark Knoll's New Shape of World Christianity.
Very nice.
Well, guys, now we got the book stuff out of the way, although it was interesting, a lot to talk about. But I've got a few clips we want to get through in our remaining time. We typically just do book news, and then every once in a while we actually offer a review. But we are the Reformed Media Review, and by name don't limit ourselves strictly to books. And so we actually want to discuss and comment on a couple of clips that I found. This first one, well, as I get started, I want the listeners to know I haven't told or played these for Josh or Jeff. I'm in hopes of getting a spontaneous reaction. So we'll see how this goes this first time we try it. But this first clip I heard when I was taking an audio tour at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. I went there on Monday. I went down there and did some of the tourist stuff. And was able to download on my phone and listen to this MP3 guided tour to this Galileo exhibit, which was really fascinating. He had several of his telescopes and other exhibits that described his scientific findings and scientific devices and astronomical devices of the day. But they had a particular guided tour on the church and religion, discussing the interaction between the two during the time of Galileo. So that's our preface to this little clip, if I can fire this up.
Galileo's observations of the Sun, Venus, the Moon, Jupiter, Saturn, and the Milky Way revealed that the heavens are not perfect. Specifically, Jupiter with its orbiting moons suggested to Galileo that the Copernican idea of heliocentricity might actually be real. Although the soundbite version of the Galileo story might lead one to believe that he and the church were bitterly divided over the question of heliocentrism, It is more accurate to describe their relationship as, well, complicated. And here's how.
Now, he's just described and set up a case of Galileo's relationship to the church. Of course, you know, Galileo's findings, he did research looking into the Copernican theory that the Earth revolves around the sun. Right. Now he's going to present here in just a second and make some statements regarding the church's position and the Bible's position on the subject, and I wanted to get your feedback on these. Here it comes.
First, Galileo was a devout Catholic with a well-developed sense of the separation between scientific phenomena and faith. Some scholars would say that not only was he comfortable with the sun-centered theory, or that the surfaces of the moon and the sun were not perfect as suggested by the Bible, but that he implored the church to accept what he saw with the telescope as the true and real structure of the solar system.
So he's already made the statement there that the Bible Wow. teaches that the surface of the moon and other planets was perfect.
Whatever that means.
Yeah,
I don't
what
know
does
where
perfect
that comes
mean?
From.
Where did that come? I mean, yes, God's creation is good, but what does that mean? We have the fall that intervenes between creation and you know, now or then.
And perfect. When, I mean, does he mean perfectly smooth? I mean,
I was wondering about that.
Well, here it gets better here. Okay.
His recommendation wasn't to reject or even correct what was written in the Bible, but to enhance it. He actually wanted the church to avoid making what he saw as a mistake by rejecting the Copernican theory. His observations of the moons in orbit around Jupiter convinced him that the Copernican system was right, and in the future, better proof of this would be available. Second, Galileo enjoyed friendships with leading cardinals of the Roman Church. They would often meet for dinner and discussion of many different topics. Of course, his observations and writings brought him to their attention, but mostly because some priests felt that his work was uncomfortably close to heresy and that should be censored. After all, his work did suggest that, contrary to the Bible's teaching, the earth did move and that the sun was fixed in its position.
I don't recall in the Bible where it says that the earth doesn't move.
Well, there is
there is some phenomenological language.
Right. You really got to deal. But remember, what we're dealing here with is that over time in the church, not only the church, by the way, the scientific community, and maybe they touched upon that in the broad discussion, but Galileo and Copernicus before him, were creating what we call new science. What if you've read The Structures of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, you will be familiar with the rise of what we call a paradigm, a way of understanding the world, the
right.
universe, and that one paradigm will be replaced by another as questions pile up that won't be answered adequately with the older paradigm. What happened in the Middle Ages and before that was that scientists, academics, philosophers, as well as theologians had accepted the Ptolemaic understanding of the universe. Okay? It wasn't the teaching of the Bible that was, at least not only the teaching of the Bible that was at issue, but it was the acceptance of the cosmology, I guess you would call it, of Ptolemy.
Right.
That was being challenged by Copernicus and by Galileo.
Absolutely.
So there's more. The speaker is correct that it's complex, and I suppose we ought to be happy that the discussion is getting into some of that complexity.
Yeah, here he continues.
But still.
And finally, the church employed science, particularly astronomy, in many ways. It had even allowed that the Copernican theory be used hypothetically, as a way to better calculate planetary positions. So it wasn't the church's opposition to science that complicated its relationship with Galileo. It was the church scholars' inflexibility about scriptural reinterpretation, which they really couldn't afford to allow, the clamorings from its more orthodox priests to silence Galileo and his provocative works, and Galileo's book, The Dialogues, his seemingly intentional and open ridicule of the Pope and the Church for its belief in the geocentric system that really made a difference. Even though...
The Catholic Church was not willing to reinterpret the Bible because they couldn't afford to. So where would we actually... How would we differ with that statement? Now, you might be correct. He probably is correct with the Catholic Church of the day, but we can't say that that's the case for all of Christianity.
Well, first of all, there were Protestants who also were critical. So we need to be fair.
But the important thing, because some people might see like the theology of a Pete Enns or something and say, well, you know, science needs to be able to, or with certain day age theory people, that science, some people would say that, well, science should have the power and authority to help us to reinterpret the Bible. Now, how would you react to that, Jeff, or what would you say, or Josh?
How would you correct those statements or supplement them? My initial reaction, of course, is that natural revelation and special revelation are to interact with one another. However, we also have to recognize that there is the possibility of misinterpreting Scripture.
That's what seems to be forgotten here. That there's this assumption that that Scripture cannot be misinterpreted in this whole sound clip thing.
But you know, at the end of the day, the upshot of the discussion, of course, is that the Bible doesn't teach a geocentric view of the universe, unless, of course, it's a theocentric view of the universe is actually what the Bible teaches. Theocentric, not geocentric.
But also many of the much of the language is phenomenological.
That's right.
From
the viewpoint of a man on the surface of the earth.
And in that case, as Dr. Poitras points out in Redeeming Science, it's much more accessible to all people. If you were to supply an account that was scientifically correct, then basically no one could have understood their Bible for thousands of years.
Right, and that's a problem, because the Bible was given to point the way to God and the means of salvation.
Yeah, to his people of all ages.
Right.
Right, it's not a science textbook.
Yeah, I was going to say the issue, though, of science helping us to understand the Bible, there have been times to where that has happened, you know. They did that. However, it would have to be. I would be very, want to be looking at that very closely. Mm. Anybody who would claim that science helps us to better understand the Bible, that has historically happened, and that has been a view advocated by some within our own circles, I suppose.
And we need to be comfortable, or at least allow for the possibility to say that yes, science. We should always be willing to go back to our Bible and read them in light of what we find or what we think we found. But that is a far cry from changing our principium.
Yeah. Did you notice the speaker said that it was the Orthodox priests who gave Galileo the hard time?
Right.
Okay. So in that instance, the problem was the acceptance, not of biblical teaching, but the blending of biblical teaching and Ptolemaic astronomy, Ptolemaic cosmology, driving the idea of a geocentric universe.
And it was really fascinating. I would encourage you, if anyone's able to go down there and see the Galileo and Medici exhibit at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, they have all these gadgets. Really fun things, Ptolemaic model astronomical gadgets, and then Copernican model stuff. It's just a fascinating collection of things. So anyway, I thought I'd point that out and just examine that critically. And I have, well, for the sake of time, we'll keep it to one. I'll leave my third for another day. But this one you'll really enjoy, Jeff, I think. This one is a YouTube clip. I even hesitate to play this to even give it attention, but... we're going to play this, and it's criticizing Stephen Nichols' book on Martin Luther.
Not too long ago, I read a book on the life and theology of Martin Luther. The book was titled Martin Luther, A Guided Tour of His Life and Thought. The book was written by Stephen J. Nichols, a graduate of Westminster Theological Seminary. Let me just begin by saying that this was the worst book I have ever read on Martin Luther from someone claiming to be a Calvinist.
That's a good way to start.
Wow.
Continuing.
Only one from Westminster Theological Seminary could manage to misrepresent the life and theology of Martin Luther to the extent one finds in this book.
So then he's begging the question, well, okay, what did Stephen Nichols say that is so wrong? Here we go.
Right.
The book is littered with mistakes, both historical and theological, but I will be focusing on those mistakes made by Stephen J. Nichols, which specifically attack the very essence of Reformed theology. I will begin with his incredibly erroneous teaching concerning the foundational principles of Reformed theology, known as the five solas of the Reformation. Stephen J. Nichols writes, and I quote, "Luther garners attention not solely for his involvement in the Reformation events, but also because of his role in shaping Reformation ideas. Perhaps more than any other person, Luther shaped the presuppositions that define Protestantism." Theologians use a series of Latin expressions to capture these concepts, known as the Reformation solas. They include sola scriptura, scripture alone, sola fide, faith alone, sola gratia, grace alone, solus Christus, Christ alone, sola Deo gloria, to the glory of God alone. These ideas all take root in Martin Luther's thinking. End quote. Taken from Martin Luther, A Guided Tour of His Life and Thought, Introduction, page 16. Of all, to say that Luther shaped the principles of the Reformation is to imply that they originated from Luther and not from the Bible alone.
Okay.
How does that follow?
Here we go.
Before we go any further, this man is possibly confusing sola scriptura with nuda scriptura.
I don't know. I am confused myself, Jeff. Why don't you explain?
Well, nuda scriptura would be what we sometimes refer to as theological Anabaptism.
Right.
No creed but the Bible mentality. I don't know that that's the case, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Here you go. Well, so far the comment he's made is saying he'll explain it here.
He said something about this being Reformed theology. As much as we owe to Martin Luther, and we do, for kicking off the Protestant Reformation, his theology can be called Reformation theology, but I don't know anybody who would intelligently refer to Martin Luther's theology as Reformed.
Sure.
Right, good point.
Okay.
Good point.
That they originated from Luther and not from the Bible alone. Roman Catholicism often makes this same mistake when they argue against Protestantism, the same mistake Nichols is making here. The five solas were not shaped by Luther. They were discovered by him as he studied the Bible alone. Compare Nichols' Roman Catholic remark with a remark by the great Calvinist Gordon H. Clark. Clark writes, quote, "When we think of the Reformation, we usually think first of the doctrine of justification by faith, but the Reformers also discovered assurance. The proper word is discovered, for they came out of a medieval background of superstition and fear." End quote.
So the issue he has is that Nichols says that Luther shaped the presuppositions, and he would like for Nichols to say that Luther discovered the solas.
Well, by use of the word shaped, that implies that they pre-existed his coming to them. Right? I mean, that's just maybe I'm getting as picky as this gentleman is.
Right, that's the point I was going to make. I think that he's straining at a gnat here.
Yeah, that seems to be more of the case, that Steve Nichols... We've had him on the show. Jeff, you're friends with him, and
This is I don't mean to be rude, but the kind of comment calling Steve Nichols' comment just the equivalent of Roman Catholicism
right
is ludicrous. at the base of the comment.
But just being the point that, that Luther was a crucial figure used by God
right.
to, in our opinion, bring the church back to where it started, or at least to reform the church from where it had strayed.
I mean, we would argue, right, that God uses means, right?
Sure. And to do Definitely. That is not to say that Luther invented the solas. No. Neither is Steve Nichols saying he invented them and imposed them upon Christianity, but certainly Luther found these principles and helped shape and guide them in the very idea of bringing them to light.
Right.
But not that they're things that God didn't teach or intend, but that Luther made them up. That's not the case at all, and that's not what Steve is talking about.
And he didn't read his Bible in a closet all by himself. He had conversation partners.
Yeah, he wasn't in a vacuum.
Right. So, I mean, this is...
Well, and even using the word discover, as he seems to enjoy Gordon Clark's use, we could strain at the word discover, too, and say he discovered and try to invest the word discover with invented, too.
Right.
Or even say discovered, you mean nobody saw this before him?
Yeah, exactly. That's even worse in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, are you saying that Gordon Clark was the first one to ever see these things in scriptures? Because that's usually when we say someone discovered something, that's the first one to right. bring it out and to right. to codify it.
So before Gordon Clark, nobody ever understood the authority of scripture or the proper word. Right.
Right. If we were going to strain at the language as our YouTube friend is doing here, we could do the same thing with Gordon Clark on this same point. I just think that it's straining at a gnat here to try to find things wrong with it. I mean, if you read that on the face of it, he's saying these are things that Martin Luther brought to the attention of the church at the time of the beginning of the Reformation. Right. That's his point. I mean, and to take, you know, one little word and to just drive it to a meaning where Nichols isn't taking it, I think, is more than uncharitable.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's about all I wanted to play.
That was interesting.
That's about all I could take.
Yeah, sometimes you wonder about the benefit of playing stuff like this, but I thought it'd be interesting to get your reaction. But that's out there, and we need to think critically. And just because somebody says something doesn't mean we need to listen to it or believe it. But as Christians, we always have to keep our minds sharp. And that's what we're trying to promote here. And people criticize us, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. So,
no.
And just for other,
we're not right all the time, believe me.
Right. And just for a plug, Stephen Nichols' books are on the historical figures, Calvin and Luther, are excellent. My wife and I both have gone through them together, and they're excellent books, well worth our readers, our listeners to read through them.
Yes, and we've had him on the program twice and enjoyed every minute of it. Actually, probably some of our most fun and for us, most enjoyable episodes.
Yeah, his give and take with Derek Thomas is classic.
Yes. I'll try to put the jazz book, right?
Yeah. This is a book on the blues. Looking at a theology of blues music. Yeah, it was fantastic. And then Jesus Made in America.
Yeah.
Which was also a fun one. And I'll put links to those in the show notes so everyone can get them. Also, as best I'm able, put the entire bibliography up. I think I got most of them, but I'm going to have to go listen to a few
more. Put a link
times.
To the book on Luther and let people read it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'll put a link to those two clips. They're freely available online, one from the Franklin Institute, the other on YouTube. And I'll make those available for people as well.
That's right.
Thank everyone for bearing with us with our long book news. And these two short commentaries. We appreciate you listening. Look forward to all the new stuff we're going to be doing on the web. You can visit us at reformedforum.org, and you can visit Josh at his site, bringthebooks.org. Great site as well. Stay tuned for more from Craig Blomberg and the guys. And we hope you'll join us again on the Reformed Media Review.